Next case is Vincent Wilkerson v. Superintendent Fayette, SCI.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. Assistant District Attorney Max Kaufman for the Commonwealth. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine.
Thank you.
I'll tell you right up front, we're going to go well into extra innings here, so we have a lot of questions on this case, and I'm going to preempt you, if you don't mind, to try to channel the
by all means
the discussion a little bit. One of the things that's curious about this case is it's a sentencing challenge, but yet the double jeopardy language sort of evokes a challenge to the validity of the convictions themselves. Do you see any meaningful distinction between the convictions, the validity of the convictions, or the validity of the sentences, or is that sort of a red herring?
Well, I think it points out that the claim was not exhausted in state court because a merger claim implicates sentence. So the fact that they asked for sentencing relief and sentencing relief was not granted indicates it's a merger claim, not a double jeopardy claim that was raised in state court, and thus failure of exhaustion.
Well, doesn't Anderson say to the contrary, though? I mean,
it seems
that the federal double jeopardy claim was fairly presented to the state court by virtue of the citation of Anderson.
Well, that's what Harmon held, Your Honor, and we do dispute that, but it's not really dispositive here because we think we prevail on the merits. But I would say that this tension that you recognize between the sentencing and the conviction does point out that it's actually a merger claim, which is evaluated under a different standard in state court, which did not exhaust the double jeopardy claim in federal court.
But we have, McCandless tells us that there are different categories of ways that one can fairly present a claim to the state court. One is the reliance on state cases that employ a constitutional analysis.
In a like-fact situation, Your Honor, and this is a bit that Anderson also did not involve a like-fact situation because it involved a single criminal act, whereas in this case you have multiple criminal acts. And also, McCandless decision would seem to be in tension with Baldwin, which holds that if you have to read beyond the party's briefing to ascertain a federal question, then that's not sufficient for exhaustion purposes. And that would be the case here. There's nothing in the briefing.
Let's focus on that, because they did raise constitutional issue in the intermediate court, but the petition for allowance of appeal dropped some of those, right?
It just went up to the Superior Court. The petition for allowance of appeal was denied. All the Superior Court was cite that Anderson decision, and there was nothing in the body of the briefing which indicated that it was a federal claim. The court would have had to go and read the Anderson decision and see that there was some discussion of double jeopardy embedded in that opinion to discern a potential federal claim in this case. And the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Baldwin says that's not good enough. Drive-by citation to a state case which has some federal discussion hiding away in it is not sufficient for exhaustion purposes.
Well, but if it's a state case that's in perfect overlap with a federal constitutional right, as is the case here between merger and double jeopardy, that's just Pennsylvania law. We can't change that. You think that's incorrect, we can't do it.
Well, I think the error with Anderson, though, is it got federal law wrong because it construed the double jeopardy clause to be that analysis to be coterminous with Blockberger.
Right, but we can't change that. We have to expound
on what the state court says about federal law. You're bound by what the state court says about state law.
But we're looking at the question of whether the state court was on fair notice that there was a federal constitutional claim presented. Now that the state court, because it held in Anderson, that they are the same. So isn't the point that a citation to Anderson would have put the Superior Court on notice that there was a federal double jeopardy claim that was being raised by way of that citation?
We certainly don't concede the default question here, Your Honor, but we would submit that 2254B2 allows this court to address the merits, notwithstanding any potential failure to exhaust. And we would submit that that probably is the preferable approach in this case because the procedural default question is complicated. So I mean,
we're not daunted by the complication. We want to make sure we get it right, and we're told under AEDPA that we have to decide the procedural default in our jurisprudence. We have to decide that procedural default question first, right?
Right, correct, Your Honor.
So help us work through that. Let's say, the citation to Anderson is really raising the issue of whether when something is a lesser included offense of another crime, what the test will be to determine whether they're the same for double jeopardy purposes,
yeah.
Right?
But Anderson applied state law merger to a situation where there was a single criminal act. So we submit it doesn't involve a federal constitutional analysis.
And two sentences, right?
Correct.
Right.
And it doesn't involve similar facts. So even assuming you can exhaust via drive-by citation to a state court case, Anderson didn't do it for this petitioner. That's our position via the citation to Anderson.
All right, so that gets to the point here that the Superior Court made a determination, some would say factual, I'm not sure that's right, but in any event, Superior Court made a determination that there were two separate crimes at issue here, correct?
Correct.
And do you view that as a factual determination or a legal determination that the evidence was sufficient that the evidence was sufficient to find two criminal acts?
I view it as a factual determination, but it's not just me. This Carmen repeatedly.
Yeah, we write in that. Harmon's an NPO, right?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
So we're not bound by it, but why?
You're not bound, but it's a recent decision, same issue.
But why is it factual? I mean, we do a lot of appeals where we're reviewing sufficiency of the evidence. I think we've typically viewed that as a legal determination. The evidence of record, such as it is, legally sufficient to convict?
Well, as this court noted in EPI, there can be factual questions along the way to deciding a legal question. In Eli, it was a sufficiency claim, and this court held that there was a binding fact-finding by the state court in the context of a sufficiency analysis. And I think the same would hold true in this case.
So what facts were found by Superior Court?
That the act of pistol-whipping this victim twice and then stepping back and shooting him in the chest were two distinct and separate criminal acts.
Isn't that a legal conclusion?
Yeah.
Well, again, Harmon says that it's a factual question.
But again, Harmon is an NPO, we're looking at this case that's been presented to us without Third Circuit precedential opinions that govern it.
Okay. Well, Harmon was a recent decision in deciding the same issue. I understand you're not bound by it, and I don't think it's necessarily outcome determinative whether it was a factual or a legal determination. If it was a legal determination, you're still obliged to affirm if it was reasonable under D1.
I thought you were going to say if there's no clearly established law that violated, then we affirm.
Well, that's certainly true as well.
Can we just step back before we get to the
and that would be why it would be reasonable
to the standard that we use and whether epideference is appropriate. If we're not persuaded that the citation to Anderson is enough to get over a procedural default, McCandless also has categories of an assertion of a claim in terms so particular as to call to mind a specific right protected by the Constitution, an allegation of a pattern of facts that's well within the mainstream of constitutional litigation. Our court has held after Baldwin that McCandless is still good law and that these categories are still the ones that we look to. Why wouldn't the claim that was raised in the state court, putting Anderson aside, but just the argument that's being raised that I've been punished twice here for the same act, doesn't that fit into the third and fourth categories of McCandless to get over the deliberate
indifference? The question is, initially, is what was the legislature's intent? We have no argument along those lines. They went directly to Blockburger. Now, that's only in the alternative if the legislative intent is unclear.
I'm sorry, what legislative intent are you talking about?
The legislature's intent to impose multiple punishments. It's only in the alternative that you go to Blockburger. The language that you're talking about referred to Blockburger. That is the test under the state merger law doctrine, not under the federal double jeopardy clause.
The question is, when someone is making an argument...
Well, that argument alluded to Blockburger, which is the standard for a state law merger claim.
But doesn't that require a state court in evaluating the claim that's been raised to address the two issues? That is, are there two separate offenses where the elements don't overlap, number one, but also, are there two different acts? Isn't that implicit in the analysis?
What would the state court think if confronted with that language? And our answer is they would think it was a state law merger claim challenging the sentence. I mean, that's what he was asking for on appeal, is to have the sentence vacated. But, of course, the remedy for a double jeopardy violation is to have the conviction vacated. And that's not what he was asking for.
Well, what do we do with the fact that the Superior Court here in its decision, whatever arguments were raised, in its decision, it's addressing there being enough for two separate convictions.
Right. Right. Well, under the Gantz case, in terms of determining exhaustion, you don't look at what's in the court's opinion. You look at what the petitioner argued, what they raised. And he resubmit raised the state law merger claim. But again, I would like to steer you back. Even if it is exhausted, we do submit that this claim fails on the merits.
All right. Let's say we get past exhaustion. Okay. Then before we get to merits, we also need to think about what is our standard of review. If we think that the state court was presented with a double jeopardy claim and the standard, the test that it then articulates to address that claim is sufficiency of the evidence, how does that comport with Supreme Court precedent in terms of the proper approach to a double jeopardy claim?
I think in the context of determining whether there were separate acts, it's in accordance with it. I mean, that's the approach that the first part of Blockburger used to determine whether there were separate criminal acts supporting multiple punishments. So it's, I would submit, in accordance with Supreme Court precedent. But at a minimum, it's not a clear violation of any Supreme Court precedent.
But if you're really presented with a double jeopardy problem, with a lesser and greater included offense, sufficiency of the evidence would answer the question as to both. I mean, if the evidence is sufficient to support the greater included offense, it's certainly going to be sufficient to support the lesser included offense. How could that be the test to determine double jeopardy?
That's exactly what Blockbuster did. The reviewing court looked at whether the evidence determined that there was separate criminal acts. And, I mean, it's not just Blockburger. I mean, this court has done similar things in the Corrin case, in the Finley case, and in the recent Harmon decision, which we all agree is not precedential, but is a recent case involving a similar claim. I would submit that approach, that sufficiency approach, is consistent with Supreme Court precedent. But at a minimum, there is no clearly established federal law saying that's wrong.
But that's what you have to show.
We don't
look to whether it's clearly established. We aren't applying AEDPA deference if the test that was used by the state court was contrary to or an unreasonable application of Supreme Court case law, right?
Well, that's what you have to determine. But you have to find, to not apply AEDPA deference, you have to determine that there's a Supreme Court decision that this approach clearly violated. And there was also an argument that they addressed the merger issue and then proceeded to discuss the sufficiency of the evidence.
Well, let's go back to whether sufficiency of the evidence is really a way that we could even think about a double jeopardy problem. So say we have a case where on the record there is evidence that could theoretically lead a reasonable jury to find the two separate acts. But in the indictment, the two offenses are charged as to wit, both pointing to a shooting. For both of the greater and lesser included offense based on the shooting on the same day. That's the argument in closing. That's jury instructions, where the jury is expressly told that same act would provide a basis for conviction. Would we really say that those things aside, what we look to is sufficiency of the evidence of the trial record?
Well, what you're suggesting is that the jury has to find separate criminal acts, and the case of Oregon v. Ice forecloses that. It says that Apprendi does not apply in the multiple punishments context. So, I mean, that argument is completely foreclosed by Oregon v. Ice.
We're talking here about double jeopardy and what test we use to ascertain if there's one or two acts.
Correct.
And what the relevant aspects of the trial
are. And
what Blocker
tells us is that it's the reviewing court analyzing the totality of the evidence and seeing whether it supports two separate acts. And Oregon v. Ice says it's not a jury question. Apprendi has no place here.
Sufficiency of the evidence generally directs us to look at what evidence there was presented to a jury, right?
Sure.
So, again, going to my hypothetical, if we have a charging instrument that is identifying the same act as the basis for the lesser and the greater included offense, and say there are jury instructions where the judge has told the jury that it can find the greater and lesser on the basis of the very same act.
Which we don't have here.
That's why
it's a hypothetical.
Just wanted to clarify.
As a matter of federal double jeopardy law, is it your position that the sufficiency of the evidence of the trial record alone would avoid a double jeopardy problem despite the jury having been told it can convict on the basis of the same act?
Yes, it is my position. It's, again, the approach that was taken in Blockberger and that this court has taken in Findlay and Corin and in Harmon.
How do you square that with the Supreme Court's articulation in Ash of what the appropriate...
It's a completely different case. It's a collateral estoppel piece.
It's a double jeopardy case, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's defining it at such a level of abstraction. That double jeopardy covers a variety of things. This particular aspect of double jeopardy revolves around multiple punishments, not whether there's a jury finding at a prior trial that binds the prosecution in a separate second proceeding. That's an entirely different... There, of course, the question about what the jury found or didn't found is absolutely critical. But here we have a very different question. We have one trial, and the question is whether multiple punishments were permitted based on what were clearly, under the evidence, separate criminal acts.
Why should it make a difference when the question in double jeopardy is whether the jury is convicting for the same, there's a multiple punishments for the same act or the same offense being retried? Why would it matter if we're talking about two... accounts that are based on the same act or subsequent prosecutions, each involving one of those counts.
Because Oregon v. Ice says we don't need a jury finding here that Apprendi is inapplicable to multiple punishments. And, you know, it's about instructing the jury and what was in the charging indictment presupposed that the jury has to find separate criminal acts in this context. And Oregon v. Ice says no. And there certainly is no Supreme Court decision saying yes. And under epidefference, then I mean, the Commonwealth has to prevail.
I'm still not following. If what we look at in double jeopardy is comes down to whether someone is being prosecuted twice for the same offense, the same act, or statutes that are the same elements. Why would there be any difference in the test that we use, as the court did in Ash, dealing with a verdict in one case and in a subsequent prosecution analyzing whether that was a statute with the same elements or for the very same act as the prior verdict related to.
Well, there's a case law applying different standards. I mean, just this court, I know it was non-presidential, but in Harbin applied what is effectively a sufficiency analysis. The reviewing court took a look at the evidence and determined whether it supported separate criminal acts and concluded it did not. And that approach is consistent with Blockberger, consistent with Corn, consistent with Finley. So there's ample precedent for that, and none of those cases cited or relied on Ash or pursued that approach.
But doesn't Ash help you? I mean, you're fighting it hard, but doesn't Ash actually help the government here?
In terms of?
Well, the prosecution, the position of the defender, as I understand it, is that we should focus only on the indictment and jury instructions. In Ash, albeit dealing with collateral estoppel, the court is looking at whether the prior verdict, which happened to be an acquittal, was based on the same acts that formed the basis for the subsequent prosecution. And it says that you look to the entire trial record, including the evidence that was presented at trial. It also seems to articulate as the test that you look at whether the jury could have based that prior verdict, whatever it was, on other acts. And if so, then it doesn't give rise to a double jeopardy violation. Both of those points would seem to assist the government.
Well, certainly the latter point. I mean, our point is essentially that what the jury did or did not find is irrelevant. And we think that Oregon v. ICE strongly supports that view.
When you talk about AEDPA deference, you're talking about the need for us to defer to the Superior Court's decision, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
In what's been characterized, I think, in Judge Diamond's opinion as Wilkerson, too. In that decision, they decided that that was an incorrect view of the facts, right? Judge Diamond's decision, right, decided that the Superior Court, in denying the merger argument.
Well, he converted the claim into a jury instruction claim, so he fell into this view that the jury was obliged to find the separate criminal acts, and he couldn't determine beyond a reasonable doubt that they did base the convictions on separate criminal acts, so he granted relief.
And there was no case law cited for that in that portion of the opinion, right?
That's beyond Estelle. No, Your Honor, certainly nothing.
Estelle's just the general
jury instruction case, correct.
But what did the Superior Court decide in Wilkerson 2?
It decided that there were separate criminal acts committed when Wilkerson beat the victim and then shot him, and thus the merger doctrine, the state law merger doctrine, was not implicated.
Right. Anything else? Thank you, Mr. Coffin.
We'll address the cross appeal or wait until
rebuttal? No, we'll hear you on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Pulzetti?
Good morning. It pleases the court. Maria Pulzetti, representing Vincent Wilkerson. I'd like to start with the exhaustion issue and the double jeopardy claim. I think the court is absolutely right, looking to Lincoln's and looking to this court's precedent in Mara versus Frank that relies upon a state case employing constitutional analysis in a like fact situation satisfies exhaustion. In Anderson, as this court knows, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court relied upon Blockberger and said that it was applying double jeopardy analysis and that the double jeopardy analysis in Pennsylvania is identical to merger analysis.
But aren't we looking to whether a claim was fairly presented? And the invocation of double jeopardy, just a reference to it in the context of an argument that, look, you've already decided this is a lesser included offense of another offense. You know, see Supreme Court case law on this point. How does that fairly give notice to the state court of what seems like a very different double jeopardy claim that's now being raised, that it's a violation of double jeopardy to base two offenses on what may have been, what a jury could have come to be a single act in view of allegedly deficient jury instructions or a charging instrument? Aren't those different double jeopardy claims?
I don't think that. I think Mr. Wilkerson was making the same double jeopardy claim that was being made at Anderson. Anderson was also a case where the charges were attempt murder and aggravated assault. And Mr. Wilkerson was also making the argument that his conviction for aggravated assault could not be punished separately because it was part of the attempt murder conviction.
But that's just the Blockberger, that is the Blockberger test, and that's the Superior Court acknowledging, recognizing that that's the test that the states are using too for a merger analysis. That only goes to the definition of what's a, when is a lesser and greater included offense, a merger problem and a double jeopardy problem. The claim that's being raised now is not whether these are, as statutes should be merged, or whether one is a lesser included offense of another. It's a much more complex and nuanced double jeopardy claim about what the right test is to ascertain whether something is one act or two acts. And in the realm of the trial record, what are the parts of that record that one can permissibly rely on to determine if you have one or two acts? How were those questions fairly presented to the state court?
Mr. Wilkerson's obligation was to fairly present a double jeopardy claim to the state court that his two convictions, that his separate punishment for the aggravated assault conviction violated double jeopardy. His appellate brief said that said that he couldn't be punished separately for the aggravated assault. It relied for that on merger and on Anderson, which cites Blockberger, but that it exhausts the double jeopardy claim. Exhaustion doesn't require a petitioner to make every single permutation of an argument in state court. It requires the petitioner to put the state court on notice that a constitutional claim is being litigated. And under NARA and also under McCandless, Mr. Wilkerson articulated a constitutional claim in terms specific enough that he could not be punished separately for this offense because it was a lesser included offense of his attempted murder conviction. That is what a double jeopardy claim is. And the way that a court gets to decide, and I would love to talk about Ash when we talk about the merits, the way that a court decides that is not a question of whether you've exhausted your double jeopardy argument. It's how the court handles the double jeopardy argument.
So an invocation of a constitutional right or a clause of the Constitution should be deemed sufficient to put the state court on notice of all the different claims that could be raised for that provision?
I guess I'm not fully understanding all the different claims that you think might be raised. He's claiming that he can't be punished twice for the same offense. That's a double jeopardy claim and a murder claim. I don't think it's an unusual permutation of a double jeopardy claim. I'm sorry that I'm not getting to what you're asking.
Let me try it one more way. It appears that the argument that was made to the Superior Court was simply, look, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court already decided in Anderson that this is a lesser-included, aggravated assault is a lesser-included offense of attempted murder. You can't convict someone of both the same act. And cites to Anderson, which relies on Blockberger for the proposition of these things looking to elements to determine if it would be a double jeopardy violation too. The answer, the assumption to that argument was that there was one act. And the answer that the state court gives in its opinion is simply we recognize that would be a double jeopardy problem if we were presented with it, but we're not. We don't even have to address double jeopardy because this case involves two acts. That's a very simple double jeopardy argument that was raised. The court answered it in a very simple way. And now on federal habeas, there's what seems like a very different and very interesting but different claim that's being raised about how is it that we go about defining whether something is one or two acts. What's required under double jeopardy law to ascertain that, and what kind of evidence can you rely on in the state trial record to make that determination?
Right.
Aren't those different claims under double jeopardy?
I don't think they're different claims under double jeopardy. I think it requires a particular analysis, but I think for exhaustion purposes, they're not different claims. I think it's clear, as Your Honor noted from the Superior Court opinion, the Superior Court was on notice that there was a double jeopardy issue. In fact, the Superior Court mentions double jeopardy. I think it's Appendix 718. And the Superior Court looked at Blockberger and said when these convictions are based on the same act, they violate double jeopardy. When they're based on separate acts, they don't. This is separate acts. That's their double jeopardy analysis.
Which is another way of saying there really isn't a disagreement about the law. We all know that aggravated assault is a lesser included offense of attempted murder. But there was a disagreement about the record, correct?
Right.
And if we could get to the merits, can you tell us where the Superior Court violated clearly established law when it held that the state court record was sufficient to support separate crimes?
Right. So this is a violation of clearly established federal law as we see in Blockberger itself, as we see in Ash versus Swenson.
Well, hold on. Let's slow down a little bit because my fear is you're going to cite cases that stand for very general propositions, and we have to be careful in AEDPA. We've been cautioned many times by the Supreme Court to not just cite general principles of law. I think in order for you to carry the day on a violation of clearly established law, you have to point us to a Supreme Court decision that says that the Superior Court wrongly reviewed this record and concluded that there were separate crimes for aggravated assault and attempted murder in the form of a pistol whipping on the one hand and a shooting on the other hand.
So as we've argued in our briefs, there are multiple factors that the Supreme Court cases look at. In Ash, which has the most factors, probably the fastest one to look at, the Supreme Court looks at the charges, the evidence, the instructions, and the verdict. And as Judge Gross pointed out, it looks at the totality of the circumstances of the record. I do not concede that the Superior Court here looked at the totality of the circumstances of the record at all. All I can see from the Superior Court's opinion is that they looked at the sufficiency of the evidence.
By definition, that means you look at the record, right?
I think it means you look at the testimony, the Commonwealth's case, in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth.
But not the jury instructions?
No.
All right, but how do the jury instructions help you here? Because one jury instruction adverts to the shooting and the other one doesn't.
Right. The attempted murder instruction refers to the shooting. The aggravated assault instruction does not refer to any facts at all. And as the district court explained, there was no instruction to the jury and also no argument to the jury at any time to base the aggravated assault conviction on a fact separate from the shooting. The Commonwealth didn't make that argument to the jury. The instructions did not make that argument to the jury, and therefore there is a reasonable probability that the jury applied the instructions in an unconstitutional way.
That might be true if it were a case on direct appeal, but one of the things that was troubling about the district court's analysis, at least to me, was that it appeared as if the court was exercising de novo review there, because I would have expected the court to, instead of making its own determination that when I, the federal district judge, review this record, I think there's a substantial likelihood or a fair probability that the jury was misled here. What the analysis should have said was, the Superior Court violated clearly established Supreme Court law when it determined that there were two separate crimes. There's really not any analysis by the district court along those lines, is there? And if I'm correct about that, then the case would turn on the standard of review, would it not?
Well, I think we prevail on whether we conclude that the Superior Court didn't apply the correct constitutional analysis and therefore the review is plenary here, or whether we look at it through 2254 D1 or possibly D2, although I don't think D2 is particularly helpful.
Do you think,
it's
a factual determination or a legal determination?
I mean,
Harmon said factual, but I'm not sure that's accurate. I mean, when you say sufficiency of the evidence of an appellate court, that strikes me generally as a typical legal determination.
Me as well. At best, maybe a mixed question of fact and law, but I also see it as a legal determination, and I see that the Superior Court did not apply the multi-factor test, even in Blockberger, that relied on the indictment and the evidence for the two drug sales that were indicted on two separate days. The evidence showed they were on two separate days. The Supreme Court said that is not a continuous criminal act. The defense was that the defendant continually sold to the same buyer and therefore was continuous. The Supreme Court looked at the indictment and the evidence and said that's not a continuous criminal act. Here, we have a continuous criminal act, unfortunately a violent encounter outside a nightclub that resulted in a shooting, but it was a continuous criminal act. It's not an act that occurred on two different days or that was indicted separately. Or
Is continuous criminal act the pollster, though? Because that seems to track what Justice Cappy wrote in his dissent in Beslar. And Justice Flaherty's opinion for the majority in Beslar, you know, disagreed with that. How does that help you?
Well, I think the Blockberger analysis on whether we're looking at separate acts or continuous acts, it has to be. We have to apply Supreme Court case law to that.
But Blockberger tells us that if in the course of a 10 or 15 minute criminal assault, that you can only have one crime, that, you know, is that what Blockberger, I don't know that that's what Blockberger teaches. Couldn't you have multiple crimes occurring in one assault?
Well, absolutely you could if they were charged and instructed in that way. I'm not saying
multiple crimes were charged and multiple crimes were instructed, and the state court made a determination, you know, factual, legal, I'm not sure it matters, but the state court made a determination that these were two separate crimes, correct? So isn't it incumbent upon you under AEDPA to show us why that was contrary to or an unreasonable application of clearly established law as determined by the Supreme Court?
Yes, I assume that we need to show that we can prevail under AEDPA, and it is contrary to, because the Superior Court looked at only one factor. As far as we can see, it only looked at the sufficiency of the evidence in performing this analysis. It didn't look at the totality of the circumstances of the record. It didn't look at the charging instrument. It didn't look at the counsel's arguments. It didn't look at jury instructions. So on this record, we cannot conclude that the jury found two separate criminal acts. There is a real possibility the jury based the aggravated assault conviction on the shooting.
Even if we get to that point, I mean, don't we have a situation here where, on this record, a jury could have based both convictions on the same act? Given the ambiguity in the jury instructions, given the evidence in the trial, and the absence to any reference here in opening closing that would give further guidance, or the charging instrument for that matter, to give further guidance to the jury. So the jury could have based both convictions on one act. But when we've got Ash, we've got Regas, we've got various cases where the federal courts have looked at the totality of the record, aren't we told that the test is not whether a jury could have based it on the same act? It's whether the court is persuaded that the jury couldn't have based it on the same act. That is, there's no double jeopardy violation as long as there is the possibility that the jury based its verdict on two different acts instead of one. Isn't that what Ash teaches? And given this record, even if we do a plenary review, doesn't that suggest that relief would still be denied?
I don't read Ash as saying that the burden is to show no possibility that the, or to show definitively that the jury, I'm sorry, I'm trying to restate your question, to show definitively that the jury didn't base its decision on the same act.
Ash essentially says that there's no double jeopardy violation if a reasonable jury could have based the prior verdict on grounds that wouldn't violate double jeopardy. And that's the inverse of the test that you're asking us to use. But hasn't the Supreme Court in the double jeopardy context, again, albeit in collateral estoppel, but in ascertaining whether we have there were two prosecutions for the same offense, hasn't it used the inverse of that that test that you're espousing?
I think there's some distinction here in the collateral estoppel context from the conviction context, right? So in collateral estoppel, you're looking at an acquittal, right? Whereas here, we're looking at what the jury convicted, and to determine the basis of the jury's conviction, I don't think the district court was incorrect in using Estelle and Boyd, which are, in fact, habeas cases, not direct appeal cases, and saying that the burden on the petitioners to show the reasonable probability that the jury had the instructions in an unconstitutional way.
But those are due process cases. We're looking at a double jeopardy claim.
I understand.
When we're looking at, and I know you wish our red light would go on,
but
when we're looking at how the Superior Court viewed this issue of two sentences, separate sentences for the same incident, and the Superior Court said that really you could parse out the facts here and you could find facts sufficient to support attempted murder and facts sufficient to support ag assault. What wasn't the real violation, though, in your view, even if there were two separate crimes and enough facts in that whole incident to support those two separate crimes, isn't the problem that as a legal matter, those crimes merge for sentencing purposes and separate sentences were imposed? I mean, even if there's sufficient evidence for attempted murder and sufficient evidence for ag assault, you could take the shooting and make that part of the attempted murder and everything else as the ag assault. When it comes to sentencing, that because they have, because the elements of one subsume the elements of the other, it sort of merged for sentencing purposes. Isn't that really the violation?
Well, they merge for sentencing purposes when based on the same act, I think. If the Commonwealth had established, which I don't think now, that the convictions are based on separate acts, then I don't think they would merge for sentencing purposes. Right?
They would not merge if they were separate
acts. If they were separate, they wouldn't merge.
But if we had an indication, and I think we have no indication that the jury here based the convictions on the acts, but if we did...
When an act is not defined, I assume, by the 15-minute episode in total, right? I mean, there can be separate acts within the incident, right? A shooting is an act, a pistol whipping is an act, a kicking is an act. I mean, that's what Beslar teaches, right? I mean...
Right, there can be separate, absolutely. The question here is whether the jury was asked to find a separate act as a basis of the aggravated assault.
All right, so you're really focused on what the jury was invited or instructed to do as opposed to what the record evidence said.
Well, there's one other matter of evidence that I would like to raise, which is that at the conclusion of the Commonwealth's case, the defense, I'm sorry, that's not what I wanted to say. During the Commonwealth's case, the Commonwealth stipulated to the entry of the victim's medical records, which showed, according to the defense argument, which the Commonwealth didn't rebut, the medical records showed that the victim did not have facial injuries or facial bleeding. And this was in direct contradiction to the Commonwealth witnesses who testified that from the hitting with a gun, the victim had facial bleeding. So the defense argued that if there was this hitting with the gun that occurred, it wasn't serious bodily injury because there was conflicting evidence here and the medical records didn't show any injury as a result.
So there was no broken jaw, no lost teeth.
Right, no facial trauma, etc. Right. So the jury, before it, has this sort of factual problem. All testimony says one thing, the medical records say another thing. And one can imagine the jury saying, well, you know, the bullet was certainly a serious bodily injury. Let's base it on that. And that's, of course, that we don't get that from looking at the sufficiency of the evidence because that's the converse analysis. That's just simply looking at the light and most favorable to the Commonwealth. But there was a real factual dispute here about whether the beating with the gun caused serious bodily injury. And there was a factual dispute about the robbery on which the jury acquitted. So the jury did not believe all of the Commonwealth's evidence. The jury assessed it in its own way and returned a verdict. The jury's verdict, of course, doesn't tell us the jury's reasoning, but I would love to briefly address the cross-appeal.
That's what I was just asking my colleague, but we may have a couple more questions on the merits, and then we will have to deal with that Apprendi issue. Right.
I just like to understand, in the normal course, where different offenses are charged, a judge and jury instructions just goes through the elements of those offense and doesn't, as the judge here did with respect to one count, specify an act that informs that count. We end up with a general verdict as to the various counts. In any such case, it could be that the jury, in the course of its deliberations, based the different counts on the same act. If we were to agree with the position that you're taking, wouldn't that mean that in every case where there's a general verdict, that there was a double jeopardy violation, that someone had stated a claim for a double jeopardy violation, simply because you don't know on the basis of the record that it could have based both offenses on a single act? That can't be the law, can it?
Well, I imagine in most of those circumstances, the separate convictions are not lesser included offenses of each other, right?
Let's say they are. So you just don't know whether the jury did or didn't. There's nothing in, there's just ambiguity from the charging instrument through the jury instructions.
Well, the law is absolutely clear that a defendant can't be punished twice for the same act. So,
what does the court look to determine whether there was a double jeopardy violation in that circumstance?
It looks at all the circumstances of the record, right? So it looks at what arguments were made to the jury. It looks to the instructions. It looks to the verdict sheet, if there's anything useful in the verdict sheet. It looks to the indictment, which we don't have the bills of information of record here, but they are often useful.
Doesn't it also look to the trial record?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, because in your brief, I understood that your position to be that you shouldn't look to the trial record, that you're limited to the charging instrument and to the jury instructions. But in view of Ash, is it now your position that you actually can look to the full trial record to make the determination about whether the yes. offense are based on the same yes. act or not?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, why don't we move on to the cross-appeal?
Thank you. I'd like to start with the merits on the cross-appeal because I can tell you a little bit about why I brought this cross-appeal.
We think we'd like to start with the procedural
Absolutely,
bar.
Your Honor.
We've got several questions. We've got timeliness. Well, let's assume, I don't know if my colleagues have any questions, but I'm prepared to assume for purposes of argument that we don't have a jurisdictional bar, but we've got several other issues. Was it timely filed? Did you fairly present the claim? why was it timely filed?
Okay, so you're talking about the relation back question.
Right.
Yes.
And then underlying that is you have to show that it was closely related enough to the same facts, right?
Yes. Yes. So the Apprendi claim is not based on a single fact that is different from the double jeopardy claim. There are no new facts that form the basis of the Apprendi ineffective assistance of counsel claim, right? And under Mail versus Felix, we know from the Supreme Court that when claims are based on a common core of operative facts, they do relate back to a timely filed claim.
Help us understand that, because while they both may relate to serious bodily injury, one is the serious bodily, whether the shooting was used as the serious bodily injury for the aggravated assault, as a double jeopardy claim relating to that count, mm-hmm. right, that charge. The other is whether there was a finding of serious bodily injury over and above the attempted murder in the course of the shooting as to a different count. While both of them may abstract deal with serious bodily injury, it's different bodily injury in question. It's dealing with different charges. How at the level of specificity that we need, because it's not enough to say it's the same jury trial, it's the same, right, it was the same verdict. How does one relate to the other?
I think the easiest way to answer that question is to say the Apprendi claim is based entirely on the instruction for attempted murder, right? So the instruction for attempted murder and the verdict on attempted murder does not require the jury to find serious bodily injury as an element, right? That is the instruction for attempted murder, and what that required the jury to find is, as we've been discussing, a very big part of the double jeopardy claim, right? But it is the entire basis of the Apprendi claim. Those are the facts that the Apprendi claim is based upon. Again, and the Commonwealth Act doesn't, it's undisputed that the jury did not find serious bodily injury as a result of the attempted murder. It simply wasn't charged that way, right?
But the double jeopardy claim is going to the aggravated assault charge.
Right, so they have different legal theories, but that's also permitted for relation back, right?
But how do they relate in any way to the same core of operative facts?
Well, the operative facts are the elements of the offenses, and in particular here, the elements that the jury was charged upon for attempted murder, and that the elements of the attempted murder offense do not include serious bodily injury in order to get the maximum sentence.
But how does that relate to the double jeopardy charge? Can you link them up?
Right, okay, so the double jeopardy charge, so the Commonwealth made this argument, and so I'm happy to address it. So the Commonwealth said, well, the double jeopardy charge is about the aggravated assault, but the double jeopardy, of course, can't only be about the aggravated assault. In order to have double jeopardy, you have to have two convictions or two sentences. So the double jeopardy claim deals with the aggravated assault and the attempted murder and tries to sort of untangle whether they're based on the same injury, in fact, which is the shooting, right? So the double jeopardy claim does not look only at the aggravated assault conviction. It has to look at both. It necessarily has to look at both convictions to determine whether they're based on separate acts or based on the same act. You cannot look at the double jeopardy claim and only look at the aggravated assault conviction. Relief is to the aggravated assault conviction, that I concede, but the double jeopardy claim does not exist only in relation to the aggravated assault conviction. It exists in the interrelation of the aggravated assault conviction and the attempted murder conviction. The Apprendi issue exists in relation only to the attempted murder conviction, but it doesn't bring in any new facts, and that's why it can relate back. And Hodge, in 2009, this court explained that Mail applies when you have facts that differ in neither type nor time from those that undergird the timely claim. And there are these facts, the facts underlying the Apprendi claim, differ in neither type or time from facts that were asserted as a basis for relief in the double jeopardy claim. You can't assert the double jeopardy claim without explaining the elements of attempted first-degree murder and what the jury found on conviction.
It's essential to asserting the double jeopardy claim is to compare the elements of attempted murder and aggravated assault.
The issue for Apprendi is whether there was a finding made by the jury as to actual injury, right, a serious bodily injury.
Mm-hmm.
The double jeopardy claim turns on whether in convicting on aggravated assault, that was done on the basis of the same serious bodily injury.
Yes. Under Pennsylvania law, under Commonwealth versus Johnson, and the two later cases, Commonwealth versus Naranjo and Commonwealth versus Barnes, the Pennsylvania Superior Court has made clear that when you have these two exact convictions, it's an Apprendi violation to, even though there's a serious bodily injury finding as the basis, as part of the basis of the aggravated assault conviction, if it's not made also as part of the attempted murder conviction, the defendant isn't eligible for the maximum sentence. They're eligible for the lower maximum sentence, but not the aggravated maximum sentence, right? And in Commonwealth versus Barnes, which we cited in our brief, it was actually a very similar situation where on the initial direct appeal, there was a double jeopardy claim and the aggravated assault sentence got vacated on the initial direct appeal. Then he was resentenced to the maximum sentence for attempted murder, same as Mr. Wilkerson was sentenced the same way. And he brought another direct appeal from his second sentencing saying that that was a violation of Apprendi because there's no finding of significant of serious bodily injury by the jury on his attempt murder conviction, and his sentence was vacated again and remanded for the maximum sentence for attempted murder, but not the aggravated maximum sentence. So under Pennsylvania law, as much as those two claims overlap, and I think that actually goes to the formation of that question, but as much as these claims overlap, they actually can obtain separate relief under Pennsylvania law. And here we're in an effectiveness posture. We're looking at whether there was reasonable probability that had prior counsel raised this plainly meritorious Apprendi issue, there was a reasonable probability of a different outcome. And I wanted to start with the reason I brought this cross appeal is I was truly shocked that Mr. Wilkerson was not eligible for the 40-year maximum sentence and no lawyer prior to me had raised the issue. So
the issue was not a matter of instruction of the jury, it was a matter of ineffectiveness.
Well, the error arises if the jury wasn't instructed, right? But then at sentencing, and this is Appendix 670, at sentencing, the trial court asked the DA, what's the maximum sentence here on the attempt murder? The DA says 40 years. Trial court turns to defense counsel and says, do you dispute that? And defense counsel says no. And they go ahead, sentence to 4 years. I mean, defense counsel argues for a lower sentence for other reasons, but...
And that's without a finding by the jury that there was serious bodily injury.
Right, exactly. So, right. Yes.
All right. But we review for plain error, right?
Yes.
And why is this a miscarriage of justice? Are we to look at the record to see whether there was serious bodily injury?
There's no indication that we are, Your Honor. No, because it's an ineffectiveness claim, right? It's not a direct appeal. It's not a direct appeal Apprendi claim in the federal context, which I understand has a different inquiry. Here the question is whether, if any lawyer had raised this issue previously in state court, whether Mr. Wilkerson would have been afforded relief. And it's quite plain that he would have. The precedent is uncontradicted in state court.
The question, we don't have to ask the question of whether the jury was properly instructed. It would have come out the same way?
I don't think we have to ask that question, no. I don't think this court has a plain error. I don't think this court has a case directly on point to answer that question that you're asking. But it is clear in this court's precedent, this court's plain error precedent, that when there's sentencing error that results in a longer sentence, there isn't then a harmlessness inquiry done under... Under the fourth prong of plain error, there's a prejudice prong, but the prejudice again is the reasonable probability of a different result.
So you're saying it's not a miscarriage of justice. I guess I'm struggling with the fourth prong of the plain error test as to how you satisfy that if the record shows that properly instructed jury puts us in the same position we're in now.
Particularly in view of Cotton.
Right.
Well, again, Cotton is a federal criminal case, and in the Apprendi context in Pennsylvania courts, the courts simply don't look at that. And the question here is what would have happened if someone had managed to raise this earlier, whether Mr. Wilkerson's sentence had been corrected, and it clearly would have.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Polizetti.
Thank you.
Rebuttal, Mr. Kaufman?
Well, again, Your Honor.
Maybe you could start backwards with the Apprendi issue. And I know we didn't give you a chance to address that, so.
Yeah, just to, I mean, there are a number of procedural bars to parents reviewing the MD claim. First of all, Mr. Wilkerson did not file a timely notice of appeal, of course appeal, excuse me, under Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4A3.
But why doesn't it relate back?
Well, that's the next question. It's not based on the same operative facts. The operative facts supporting the double jeopardy claim are the imposition of consecutive sentences for the attempted murder and the ag assault. The operative fact underlying the Apprendi claim is the sentence of 20 to 40 years for attempted murder.
But don't both of those go to the question of the shooting and the pistol whipping and the state court's analysis of the interrelationship of those two?
Well, I think the question in the mail is what facts give rise, what are the key, the essential facts that give rise to the claim? And I think to define it at such a level of generality would allow for endless relation back.
Then how do you define it? What are the operative facts for the two claims?
As I noted, the operative facts for the double jeopardy claim are the imposition of consecutive sentences for attempted murder and aggravated assault. And the operative facts underlying the Apprendi claim are the imposition of 20 to 30 years for attempted murder. What specific sentence Wilkerson got for the attempted murder is irrelevant to the double jeopardy claim.
Those are different legal theories, certainly, but we're looking at the facts from which they arise. Don't they both go to what facts in the record supported serious bodily injury?
Well, that seems to go to the legal theory. The fact giving rise to the double jeopardy claim is the imposition of consecutive. That's not a legal theory. That's just a fact that they got consecutive sentences for attempted murder, that he got consecutive sentences for attempted murder and aggravated assault. That's the fact from which the double jeopardy claim springs.
Depending on what facts inform serious bodily injury, what the findings were for serious bodily injury.
I analyze the claim, but I don't see that as the operative fact giving rise to either claim. I mean, his claim is that there was no finding of serious bodily injury supporting it. That's the whole premise.
Well, so there's the same facts, right, that inform serious bodily injury in the two counts. And that the jury was permitted to base the two counts on that same finding of a single act.
Well, he's saying with respect to the Apprendi claim that there was no finding of serious bodily injury. That's not underlying the double jeopardy claim in any way.
Well, if in both cases, despite different legal theories, what the court is doing is looking back to what were the findings underlying serious bodily injury, why isn't there enough overlap to relate back?
Well, because the analysis is what facts gave rise to the claim, not what facts a court would look at to decide the claim. And I think before we get to that, it does bear noting that there was an untimely filing of a notice of cross appeal here. And even if that's not a jurisdictional rule. It's the Commonwealth's position that that at a minimum, as a claim processing rule, enforcement is mandatory when an opposing party invokes it, as the Commonwealth has done in this case.
Well, yeah, I don't know. Well, go ahead.
Let's say we agree with you that it's a claims processing rule, and that the interests of justice exception might not otherwise extend if we don't think these were inextricably intertwined.
nonetheless, the objection is a waivable one. And while you're now arguing it's mandatory, the Commonwealth had the opportunity when our clerk of court reached out and instructed the parties to brief the question of the untimely appeal in jurisdiction, and opted not to. As a result, it went back to the district court for certification of the question. There was a motion filed in the district court. There was no opposition from the Commonwealth. Then it comes back for full merits briefing on the cross appeal. And it's now the Commonwealth's position that it is not only entitled to assert this, that it's not been waived, but it is mandatory that it be given credence by the court?
Well, again, it's not just my position. That's what this court held in the El Ali case, which is actually cited in Wilkerson's brief, that raising the untimeliness of a notice of appeal in the merits brief by the government in the first instance is sufficient to preserve the claim.
There was a failure to respond to the court's invitation to brief the matter in that case?
There may have been. I don't know for sure, one way or the other, but I think on the fact that it was raised in the merits brief. I don't think
we want to use up time on this. I'll just make the point that if the Commonwealth is interested in having this court enforce these matters, which are undoubtedly a matter of the court's discretion, demurring to the court's invitation to brief the matter is not the way to accomplish that.
Your Honor.
All right, let's move on to fair presentation. Why, in your view, was the Apprendi claim not fairly presented to the state court?
It just was never raised in any form. And Martinez can't help the underlying claim of trial court error. Martinez doesn't apply to those kind of
claims. Yeah, why? I mean, they argue they go to the Martinez bypass, and why are they wrong on that?
Well, because Martinez, the explicit language of Martinez and subsequent Supreme Court decisions interpret Martinez say it applies only to claims of trial counsel effectiveness. Now, whether it applies to appellate counsel effectiveness is currently pending in the Davila case. So arguably, Martinez could potentially save the appellate counsel variant of their claim. But the pure Apprendi claim is gone, is defaulted. And it's our position that Martinez doesn't salvage the ineffectiveness claims because we submit that they're not substantial claims.
Why not?
Because any Apprendi error was harmless. Certainly harmless under...
Do you agree that it's plain error review here?
Yes. Wilson concedes that.
And Ms. Polzetti's argument is that this was an obvious Apprendi error. We all know that. And that's the end of the matter.
It was harmless because a properly instructed jury would unquestionably have found serious bodily injury.
How do we know that? What about what she raised about the medical records, indicating no bleeding or facial damage for the pistol whipping?
Well, no. This defendant was shot in the chest and required emergency surgery to have the bullet removed, and then had substantial medical intervention post-surgery, severe pain.
Oh, I'm sorry. So just for the attempted murder, you're saying the shot to the chest is obvious, yeah.
Right. So is this bodily injury just requires a substantial risk of death? I really don't think that that's even remotely debatable, that this defendant caused this victim serious bodily injury.
All right, so does that mean it fails at step three of... We have error, and the error was plain, right? You're saying it didn't affect his substantial rights, or are you saying that at the fourth prong it would be a miscarriage of
substantial rights? Right, and it didn't affect the fairness of the proceedings because any Apprendi error was plainly harmless under federal law. Now, just to clarify, Pennsylvania state law applies harmless error to Apprendi claims as well. There's a case I didn't get to cite because Wilkerson got the last brief in the way we were filing it as appellate across appellate, but the Commonwealth versus Newman, it's an en banc decision, 99-83-86, which clearly provides that harmless error does apply to Apprendi claims as a matter of state law, and applies that Nader, N-E-D-E-R, harmless error analysis, whether a properly instructed jury would have found the element.
We go back to Martinez for a second, because they certainly do raise the argument that
PCRA counsel was ineffective for failing to raise the claim of ineffectiveness of sentencing counsel. One of the arguments raised seems to be that it's a different sentencing counsel, and therefore Martinez wouldn't apply. I'm not sure I understand the grounds for that.
That's how Wilkerson characterized our argument, but that was our position. Our position was that this claim has morphed a little bit. The claim as it was raised below was really as a pure Apprendi claim with some tag-along ineffectiveness claims. And our only point was that Martinez does not apply to that claim, because Martinez does not extend to claims of trial court error. It just doesn't. Now they've narrowed it down to a claim of trial counsel ineffectiveness. And yes, Martinez does apply to that kind of claim, but our position is it has to be substantial, and this one isn't.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Kaufman and Ms. Pizzetti. The case was very well argued and briefed. We'll take the matter under